from this morning's stuff and going on to chapter 1 because that was so good. But then I hated to miss this morning's stuff too, and so the decision got made for me when my power supply went out on my computer and I hadn't printed chapter 1 notes yet. So we're going to do what we were going to do this morning anyway. So sometimes those things kind of work out. Now, it seems pretty clear that the proclamation of the gospel message is at the very heart of the book of Acts. And it's encouraging to a church in a later age trying to proclaim the gospel by looking back and seeing how a church at an earlier age did it. And it's clear that the main task of the church is to proclaim the message of Jesus, to challenge people to repent and to respond to the gospel. But at the same time, in any historical work, there's not just one message. There's a main message in any historical work, but also there are other messages. There are pillars that support that main message. In other words, there are main issues, and then there are side issues and supporting issues. For example, one historian might focus on social events, but in the backdrop, there might be certain political events that would be important, even though they're not part of the main story. And they would probably be there to explain the social events, but they might even be there because the writer thought they were the very best example of politics and were worth mentioning. So what are some of the side issues in the book of Acts? Now, the main issue, of course, is proclamation of the word. And we don't want to lose sight of that. That's really what the Gospel of Acts is all about, or the book of Acts is all about. But there are some side issues. One is, anytime you take a stand for Christ and against culture, expect persecution. Now, turn over for a minute. Okay, we seem to have a little problem here. Yeah. Okay. Okay, we'll try this again, see if this works any better. Okay. Then so Christians who change the world stand firm in the face of persecution. The apostles are commanded to stop preaching. So they quietly say, okay, and walk out. No, that's not it. They answer very defiantly, no, we must obey God rather than man. Now that doesn't mean they'll stay forever where they're not received. They're required to faithfully bear witness. But if they're not received, then as Jesus told them in Luke 9, then they're free to move on somewhere else. Paul is put on trial. And he doesn't spend the time so much defending himself as he does spending the time he uses the courtroom as a way to share his faith. And that's exactly what Jesus said would happen over in Luke 21. And so Peter and Stephen did exactly the same thing. We don't see in the book of Acts men who are quaking in their boots because they've been arrested and put in jail and hauled before the authorities. People who are afraid they might die, even though they know that it's very possible they might die. But they're men who are courageous because they might live. And sometimes God protects these men like he did with Peter when he sent the angel to bring him out of jail. Sometimes he protects them like he did Paul when the attempt was made against his life. But sometimes he doesn't, like James who was killed with a sword, or Stephen who was stoned for his faith. And so our Christian life shouldn't be based on this false idea that God will always rescue us in the way that we think we ought to be rescued. You see, when we look at what's going on in the world, we see what's happening right at one specific point in time. But when God looks at what's going on in the world, he's able to step back and see the whole spectrum of what goes on. And so God can determine some things that may be better that don't even make sense to us. And so the important thing is not to get this false notion that God will always rescue me the way I think I ought to be rescued, and that if that doesn't happen, something's wrong. I mean, sometimes God will act to us like he did to Paul and Peter and will rescue us because that's the right thing to happen. Sometimes he will choose not to, like he did with Stephen and James, because that's the right thing to happen. The question is not really, will you die? The question is, what do you have in your life that's worth dying for? You know, the difference between the first century church and the 21st century church is the first century church was willing to undergo hardships, even to the point of death, to save the world. And in the 21st century church, we say, well, if I don't get my way, I'm going to pack up my marbles and go home. Folks, that's an attitude that we've got to change. God is calling us to lay down our lives. Look what Jesus said over in Mark chapter 10. Starting in verse 42. Calling them to himself, Jesus said to them, you know that those who are recognized as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them, but it is not so among you. For whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant, and whoever wishes to be first shall be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. By the way, just a little aside here, the Greek word there, serve, is the word deacon. Now, if you want to know, you know, we always call Jesus the great physician and the great teacher, but Jesus was also the great deacon. You know, and when I served as a deacon, one of the things that I wanted to look for was to say, am I deaconing? Am I serving the way Jesus did? Because he said, even the Son of Man didn't come to be deacons too. He came to deacon and to give his life a ransom for many. But you know, that's the attitude of Jesus. And that's what, you know, if a person ever ought to have been treated with dignity, it was the Son of God. If a person ever ought to have had his way about things, it's the Son of God. And yet he came not to get his own needs taken care of, but he came to lay down his life on behalf of other people. And until we get a church of people who say, I'm not here so people can just do for me, I'm here so I can lay down my life on others, when we get there, folks, we will have a church that will make a difference in the world. That's what the early Christians did. They encountered persecution. They lost their families, their possessions, their lives. But they stood firm because they had something in their lives worth dying for. And when you've got something worth dying for, then you've got something worth living for. Now, for those of you who just came in, what we're kind of doing is talking about the fact that the main message of the book of Acts, of course, is proclaiming the gospel. But underlying, in any historical work, underlying that main message, you have some pillars, some supporting messages that are also important. They're not the main thrust, but they're messages, and we're talking about what some of those are. And the third one of those is, the gospel is for everyone, even for Gentiles. Now, that shouldn't be such a hard concept. Jesus said that in the Great Commission. Go into all the world and preach the gospel to everybody. But for several years after Pentecost, the church taught only Jews. Fact is, we don't learn really fast sometimes. Sometimes it takes some time for things to soak in, and it did with them. But with God's encouragement, they eventually went on and taught the half-breed Samaritans, and then they went on and branched out further and taught the uncircumcised God-fearers like Cornelius, and finally took the gospel even to the pagan Greeks. And so as we go through the book of Acts, we're going to see this racial theme played out. Now, a church that impacts the world rises above its prejudices and its desire to stay at home and be comfortable because it understands everybody needs the gospel. But teaching the gospel was one thing. Bringing Gentiles into the church was an even bigger problem because it was a matter of racial prejudice. But it wasn't simply a matter of racial prejudice. There were even more problems than that. These Gentiles did not observe the law of Moses. Now, most of the Jews who became Christians, in fact, probably for a while, at least all of the Jews who became Christians, continued to observe the law of Moses. And so now, here are some Gentiles, and these Gentiles don't observe the law of Moses. How can I then come in contact with them without becoming unclean? I mean, you read the law of Moses, and there's all kinds of things that can make you unclean. For instance, if you come in contact with a dead body, you're unclean. Well, these Gentiles, they don't observe all these things, and so they're going out and touching things and eating things and doing all kinds of things to be unclean, and now all of a sudden they're in the same church with me, and how am I going to stay clean if these guys are unclean? I mean, that's a problem. And so, and then there was another question. Well, these Gentiles have come into the church. Well, we're all keeping the law of Moses. Shouldn't they keep the law of Moses? I mean, after all, they're Christians, but that's sort of, Jesus was a Jew. It was sort of founded on the law. I mean, even Paul, who proclaimed freedom of the conscience, lived as a Jew. And Paul was very clear, even in Romans, saying, well, the gospel was for the Jews first. And in fact, Paul, later on in the book of Acts, we're going to find out, he preached to the Jews first and then went to the Gentiles after the Jews rejected it. And so one of the subplots that Luke uses throughout the book of Acts is the theme that the message of the gospel is for all people, and the church has the responsibility to carry the good news to everybody. Now, another one of these supporting structures, sub-themes in the book of Acts, is that the church has a very definite life and structure and message. Luke is talking about what it means to be the people of God in a pagan culture. And what is the church like? How is it structured? What does it teach? And so it would not be at all surprising to find some references to some of these things in the book of Acts, and we do. For example, the life and worship of the church. Now, Luke's main purpose is not to give us a picture of the life and worship of the church, although to some extent he does that. Now, since that's not his main purpose, it should be no surprise to us that everything we'd like to know about the life and worship of the church, we don't find in the book of Acts. But at the same time, there are some things that very obviously are important to Luke. Because of all the things that he could have mentioned, he chose these things that he actually did mention. And so you get the idea from Luke that the church is not whatever men want it to be. The church is what God made it to be, and that's part of what he's explaining. Now, why is that so important to us? Well, we have questions of identity. Who are we as a church? Who should we be as a church? What should our priorities be as a church? Well, when we look back at the early church, we can answer most of those questions. See, how can we be a group of godly people in a pagan culture? And if so, how do we interact with each other and how do we interact with that culture? And so it seems to be important to Luke to explain some of those things. Now, because we in the churches of Christ believe that it's important to restore the New Testament church, it's also very important to us what the church is like in the first century. You see, some churches have given up on the idea of being a New Testament church and don't even try to do that. They're content to be something else. Now, to a group like this, Acts is probably not a very interesting study. Or maybe an interesting study, but not a very important study. Because some churches believe that the church is whatever they want it to be. What God created it to be in the beginning really doesn't matter so much. Now, I think a group like that has a lordship issue, but nonetheless, that's the view that a lot of groups take. What defines us is that we are people who value restoration and believe we can be the New Testament church. And the idea of restoration simply says, you know, over time, things change. You get a new car, and man, it looks good, smells good, feels good. 40 years later, if that car is still running, it's beat up, it's a red car, but it's got a brown fender on it. The right windshield wiper's missing and the turn signals don't work and things are a little different. But if you wanted to, you could go back and restore that car, bring it back to its original condition. Well, that same sort of thing has happened over the centuries in religion, and part of the fundamental principle on which we are trying to be simply the Church of Christ is to say, you know, there's all kinds of religious groups in the world, but you don't have to be any of those things if you just go back and restore what was there in the beginning, look at the New Testament and see what the New Testament church was like, go back and teach and believe and do the same kind of things, you can be the same kind of church. And so, therefore, it becomes important to us in restoring the New Testament church to find out what they were like. And so it gives us a direction, and especially it's important for a church who's undergoing a transition time like we are at Mid-County, because we're coming back to ask ourselves again as we change staff and we no longer have an internship, what direction should we go? Well, the book of Acts is a pretty good place to look for that. And so there are two ways you can read these sections where Luke describes the church. First, you could say that because they did it and because God approved it, therefore we're certainly on safe ground by doing what they did. And that's right. We want to have some assurance that our own acts are in the will of God, because being in the will of God was important to Jesus. It ought to be important to us. But that's not the whole story. In fact, you could go further and say that as long as the text gives you the idea that they were acting in accordance with the will of God, then when we do likewise, we'll be a lot closer to the will and heart of God than we could possibly be if we did something different. And that's right also. Because we not only want to know the right thing to do, we want to know the right thing to be. We want to know what our priorities should be. We want to know what our focus should be. We want to know what our vision should be if we're going to be part of what God's doing in the world. So it's right that we should pay attention to those sections of the book of Acts. But it's also right that we remember that even though those sections are important because Luke thought they were important to include them, they're also the supporting structure. They're not the central message of the book of Acts. Well, what are some of these things? For example, we find out in Acts chapter 2 and 4 that the early church meets together for teaching, for fellowship, for prayer, and for observing the Lord's Supper. Now those things, teaching, fellowship, prayer, observing the Lord's Supper, all seem to be very central to the early church. And that gives us a clue that they probably ought to be central to us as well. And so it won't hurt to stop and ask occasionally, is teaching central to the life of the Mid-County Church? How about fellowship? How about prayer? Is prayer central to the life of the Mid-County Church? Now, in this room this morning, about 8:30, there were five people who met to pray for the Mid-County Church this morning. I am very thankful for those five people, but I will also tell you that when you only have five people who come 30 minutes early to pray, prayer is not central to the life of the church. I'd like to see there be 50 people in here at 8:30 praying for the Mid-County Church. That would be pretty neat. That would tell us that prayer has become a priority. Now, I don't mean that you can only pray at 8:30 on Sunday morning. And you know, I've had little kids, and I know there are things that just don't work out. But the point then to ask is, when is prayer central to your life? And how important a role does observing the Lord's Supper play in the weekly events that happen here? And so asking these questions can be very instructive for us. And then we find out some things about conversion. We find out that people got into the New Testament church by being baptized in water after they'd believed in Jesus and after they'd repented of their sins. Now, for those of us who see value in being like the New Testament church, we'll want to be sure that we teach the same thing that they taught. And so we'll find in Acts that there's a very definite conversion process. It's not vague or hard to get a hold of, but it's very well laid out. And then we'll find some things in Acts about how the church is structured. We'll find out that there are elders in the local churches. We'll find out that teachers are very important to the local churches as well. Now, Luke doesn't tell us how these people got appointed, and so we can assume that this wasn't very important to the purpose he had in writing the book. But he does tell us enough about how the seven men were chosen to assist the apostles that we do learn that the spiritual qualities of men chosen for leadership are very important. And we learn that this was so important for the early church that when they chose leaders, they asked for the guidance of God and they took it very seriously. Now, it's very instructive for us to look at these same spiritual qualities and determine, do we find those spiritual qualities in our leaders today? And if not, then we ought to ask, why not? Because if we want to have a church with the power of the New Testament church, we'll realize that it's God's intention that spiritually mature men rise up to lead the church. And Luke is going to talk in Acts 6 about the fact that spiritual leaders have certain marks of spiritual maturity in their lives, and that's going to be important to us. And then missionaries. Now, we learn a lot about missionaries from the book of Acts. The term missionaries has kind of fallen out of favor in our world. That's not necessarily all bad. For instance, early pioneers in both the Reformation and Restoration movements had a motto that went like this. They said, call Bible things by Bible names. Now, when I was growing up, you heard that all the time. Probably haven't heard that much lately. And yet, there was actually a reason for that. Alexander Campbell. By the way, how many of you all know who Alexander Campbell is? Okay, a few do, a lot who don't. Just for those who don't, it's probably worth knowing that back. Alexander Campbell came from Ireland in the very early 1800s and soon became very disillusioned with the fact that the church he was a part of, he didn't feel like was practicing the New Testament. And so he and his father, Thomas Campbell, in fact, Thomas Campbell wrote what he called the Declaration and Address, which is one of the, which is a tremendous document that's worth reading sometime, in which he basically laid out that we ought to go back to the Bible. And so before long, they started some churches just on the idea of let's go back and follow the Scriptures and be the New Testament church. Down in Kentucky, a man named Barton Stone did the same kind of thing. And eventually those two groups merged and became what's known as the Restoration Movement, of which we're a part of. And so, but Alexander Campbell said one time that if the word you use to describe something is not in the Scriptures, chances are the concept's not there either. Now that's generally right, because there's an awful lot of religious jargon that goes around that frankly doesn't mean much to the average person, and when you begin to look at the Scriptures, is not what the Scriptures focus on. And so there's a good reason to say that. However, even though the word missionary is not used in the Scriptures, even though we talk about the missionary journeys of Paul, the word mission is there. And it's pretty clear that when Paul and Barnabas got sent out, they had a mission. In Acts chapter 12, he says, "And Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem, where they had fulfilled their mission, taking with them John, who was called Mark." And so it was pretty clear to Barnabas and Saul, they were sent out with a mission. They went out and they fulfilled that and came back. Some of the things we learn about missions from Acts are the principle of teamwork, which is the predominant method of evangelistic work in Acts, even though it's not the only one. And when we look at Paul's missionary journeys, we realize they weren't really whistle-stop tours the way we sometimes think of, because we run through the book of Acts in a hurry. Because when Paul reached an important center of population, he often stayed there for a long time, as he did, for example, in Ephesus when he taught in the school of Tyrannus. And we'll talk about that as we go through Acts. Now, we also learn from Acts how the gospel was preached. Luke records several sermons in Acts, and these sermons are not all alike. For example, the sermons of Peter and Philip were public sermons preached before large groups of people. On the other hand, Paul held an elders' workshop with the elders in Ephesus, kind of a private workshop with them to talk about what it meant to be an elder and what they needed to do. And then, of course, some sermons were even preached in a courtroom as the person was hauled in to make a defense for himself. But one thing that is clear from the book of Acts is that the same message was preached. It was preached in different ways to different groups of people, but it was the same message. Now, that's an important message for us because the demographics of our country are changing dramatically in terms of age groups, ethnic groups, backgrounds, languages, all sorts of things. Now, we cannot change the message, and we should not. But if we preach to different groups in a way that doesn't connect with them, then we're not going to have the impact on the early church, on the world that the early church did. And so when Paul was in Athens, he preached to a group of educated philosophers in a way that quoted Greek poets and played on their education. It was quite a different sermon than he preached elsewhere, but the message was the same. In fact, one time I remember when we were at Garnet Road, Marvin Phillips preached a sermon Sunday morning called "The Church of Christ Must Change." And then he preached a message Sunday night called "The Church of Christ Must Not Change." Hey, well, wait a minute. But you see, both of those are true because we must always change the way we reach out to people as people change, but we can never change what God called us to be, the basic message or who we are. And so the message is obviously important to Luke because he devotes so much space in the book of Acts to these sermons. And you kind of get the idea from reading the sermons that Luke records them in order that Theophilus could use those as models for his own evangelistic outreach. And so in that sense, Acts can be thought of as a training manual for evangelism. And so for a church that's looking for a place to get its priorities, its focus, its training, Acts is a good place to start. In other words, one of the supporting purposes that Luke has in Acts is to show Theophilus what it meant to be the church then, and therefore what it means to be the church today. Now, we've been talking about Acts with Luke as the author, and of course, one of the questions you want to ask when you look at a book is, who really did write it? Because that helps you understand its perspective. Now, the book itself really doesn't say who's the author. But to determine who wrote a book, you do two things. First, you look at the internal evidence. What evidence is in the book itself as to who wrote it? Well, the fact is, neither Luke nor Acts tells us who wrote it. But there are something in Acts called the we sections. And these we sections will be somewhat important to us as we go through the book of Acts, because when you get to a we section, you know the writer was with Paul. He's writing in the first person. During that portion of the trip, the writer was actually there firsthand experiencing what went on. And so since he was with Paul at various times, you look at who was with Paul in various places, and the process of elimination brings you to Luke as an obvious choice. We know, for example, that the writer was a member of Paul's group at times. We know that he sometimes used medical terms in the book. The style of the book makes it clear that the writer was a man of great culture and education. For example, those people who are scholars in Greek, if you've had many classes, you probably know that there were two types of Greek. There was what's known as the Koine and the classical. Now, the Koine was what the average person spoke on the street. It was the common language of the people, and if you were to walk down the street and talk to somebody, you'd be talking to them in Koine Greek. Now, if you were to pick up one of the works of the great writers, Homer or somebody like that, you'd be reading classical Greek, a much higher level, more educated type Greek. And the fact is that even though Luke and Acts are written in Koine Greek, it's such good Greek that it's almost classical. I mean, the writer very clearly was a very well-educated man, and so Luke fits that. Now, Luke is not identified in the text as the author, but when you look at the we sections, you see that Luke was with them. We know that that Luke was a medical doctor, and so we know that he was with Paul at certain times. For instance, in 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 11, we'll look at in just a minute, you have a reference to Luke being with Paul. And so Luke is the only one who fits all of these qualifications. Now, that's not absolutely conclusive, but it's pretty good evidence. Now, the second thing you do is you look at the external evidence, and by the year 200, several well-known and popular writers in the church had named Luke as the author. Now, even earlier than that, a very interesting thing happened. There was a man named Marcion who made up his own canon, his own list of what was in the New Testament. He decided that everybody else had gotten it wrong, and the only person who really understood what Jesus had to say was Paul. So he made up his own list of books of the New Testament, Marcion did, and he included in that list the letters of Paul and the Gospel of Luke. Now, since Luke was so closely connected with Paul, that would kind of make a lot of sense. But then the strange thing, of course, is that he didn't include the book of Acts. But finally, there's no tradition in the early centuries that anybody other than Luke wrote Acts. So it's not as if you have two or three choices to choose from. The only tradition that got passed along is that Luke wrote Acts. So the combination of all that makes us fairly certain that Luke is the author. And that's important because that helps us understand the point of view that he's looking at. But that raises another question. Okay, now, let's look at the book of Colossians for a minute, because that raises naturally the question, who was Luke? And what do we know about Luke? And the answer is, we really don't know a whole lot about Luke. Luke is in fact mentioned only three times in the New Testament. The first time, we'll look at Colossians chapter 4. And Paul starts out in verse 10, listing all the people who send greetings. And finally, in verse 14, he said, Luke, the beloved physician, sends you his greetings, and also Demas. And so, we find out from Colossians 4 that Luke was a medical doctor. Now, Luke is a Gentile name, and because it appears that those who were Jews, who had Jewish names, were listed first, that adds to the evidence that Luke apparently was a Gentile. Now look over in the book of Philemon.
Why was Luke considered part of the synoptic gospel?
Okay, that's a good question. And okay. The word synoptic really means, it kind of comes from the same root as our word synonym. Of course, synonym are two words that are alike. Well, the synoptic gospels, and of course optic, your opticals from your optics or eyeglasses. Well, these are the synoptic gospels then, or three gospels that kind of look at things alike. And so when you look at Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you'll find that they pretty much talk about the same events in the life of Jesus. Sometimes they describe it in almost exactly the same way. And so you can't really, they're so similar. And then when you get to the Gospel of John, he uses many different events, takes a much different approach to describing the life of Jesus. And so these three Gospels are called the Synoptics because you're looking at them very much the same way. Whereas John is not, because you're looking much different. Mm-hmm. So that's the reason for that. Okay, now in Philemon, and we'll look at verse 23. He says, Epaphras, my fellow prisoner in Christ Jesus, greets you, as do Mark, Aristarchus, Demas, Luke, my fellow workers. And so Luke is just mentioned here. And finally, back in 2 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 11, he says, Only Luke is with me. Pick up Mark and bring him with you, for he is useful to me for service. And so that's all the mention we have in the New Testament of Luke. Luke joined Paul's group on the second missionary journey at Troas. And so these we sections become important because they look at these mentions of Luke and say, well, where was Luke with Paul? And that lines up with these we sections of Acts. And so that helps identify Luke. And so we know that he was a Gentile. We know that he was a medical doctor. We know he was a very educated man. And we know he was involved in the spread of the gospel. Beyond that, we don't know a whole lot about Luke. Well, another question that we would usually want to ask when we start out a book is, when was it written? When did Luke write Acts? Now, when you read a history book, you'd like to know something about when it was written. The point of view that you might take toward American democracy would be quite different from a book written in the early 1800s when people all over the world were flocking to America as sort of being a refuge of liberty and the beacon of light and something that was just unheard of in the history of the world, than it would be, say, somebody who wrote a book on American democracy about the time of the Vietnam War or immediately after. Those points of view might be quite a bit different. And so you'd like to know when the book was written. Well, we know this. Paul was martyred about 65 A.D. We also know that Paul was imprisoned in Rome between 60 and 62 A.D. Now, we know from secular history that Paul got out of prison, that he went to Spain, that he was later rearrested, and then he was put to death. Now, All this indicates that the book was written. The book takes Paul right up to the point of his imprisonment in Rome. And he was there for 2 years, and then it abruptly stops. And so you get the idea that Luke wrote right up to the point of what had currently happened, and then he couldn't write anymore because that's all that had happened. Now, if that's the case, then that means somewhere around 62 A.D. would have been when the book was written, or somewhere in that period. Now, that's not an absolute argument. It might simply be that Luke had accomplished all he'd set out to accomplish in the book at that point and just quit because the rest of the story had no bearing on his purpose. And that could be, because it is true that he ends the book with Paul preaching the message of the gospel unhindered. And remember, the proclamation of the word is the major point of the book of Acts. So that may be what's going on. Certainly that's an encouraging message, and Luke definitely is an encourager. There's not much external evidence to when the book was written. An early man named Irenaeus says that it was written after Paul's death. There are some things not mentioned in the book of Acts that may help us get some clue to when it was written. For example, you don't find the destruction of Jerusalem or the temple mentioned in the book of Acts, and that happened in the year AD. And that's such a major event that you would expect it to be mentioned had it already happened. Neither is the great fire of 64. See, in 64, something happened that you may have read about in your high school history class, if you happen to be awake during that particular segment. And that was that there was a great fire that swept through the city of Rome. Now, most of the people blame Nero, the emperor, saying Nero was responsible for this fire. He wanted to rebuild the city, and the best way to rebuild the city was start out by burning it down. Now, rumors began to spread that Nero was responsible. And of course, even an emperor has only so far he can go before people finally begin to turn on you. So he found out very quickly, whether he was responsible or not, that he better find somebody else to blame. And since there were a lot of rumors floating around about this group called Christians, he decided they would be a good one to pin the blame on. And so he did that, and the first persecution of Christians officially sanctioned by the Roman Empire then started under Nero about the year 64. And so it was shortly after that that Paul was arrested and brought back to Rome and put to death. And so none of that is mentioned. And it wouldn't be very helpful. You see, as you go through Acts, when you find Roman officials involved, they're usually involved in protecting Paul or carrying out the law. They're not involved directly in persecuting Christianity. Their policies are pretty helpful. Now, it wouldn't be very meaningful for Luke to write about all these helpful policies of the empire if the official stance of the empire had changed to one of persecution. And so, again, you think the book of Acts was probably written before 64, when the empire changed its stance. Paul's death during Nero's persecution there in 65 is not mentioned. So it really does seem like that Luke probably took the book down just as far as it would go and then quit. Now finally, one last question we want to ask is, what documents did Luke use? You know, Luke got his material from more than one source. If you look back for a minute to Acts... let's look back to Luke for a minute, chapter 1. Look at what he says. Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile an account of the things accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and servants of the word have handed them down to us, it seemed fitting for me as well, O excellent Theophilus, having investigated everything carefully, to set it out in consecutive order, so that you might know the exact truth about the things you've been taught. And so, what Luke is saying is, I started out, I investigated this carefully, and I got my material from eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Now, the eyewitnesses would have been the apostles, and we'll talk about that as we get into the end of chapter 1. there's some very special things that that means, but also ministers of the word. We don't know who for sure those were, but we know of probably other disciples who weren't part of the 12, perhaps people like Timothy and Titus who were with Paul at certain points, maybe when Luke wasn't. And then, of course, we know Luke provided his own firsthand knowledge. Now, because Luke has so many similarities with Matthew and Mark, it would seem like Luke used at least one or more of the same documents that Matthew and Mark might have used in preparing it. The problem is we've never found any such document, and if one existed and were widely circulated, then at least some fragment should have come down to us. So that's a problem. Now, it's entirely possible, of course, and I think probably the most likely answer, that the Holy Spirit just had the three writers write the same thing in certain instances, because that was a message he wanted to get across. But since we do know that Luke did use some eyewitnesses' accounts, whether it's written or oral, that's not entirely a satisfactory answer either. Now, there are some parts of Acts that were almost certainly revelation. For example, he talks about what the members of the Sanhedrin said in their private sessions in Acts chapter 4 and 5. Now, it's possible that a member of the Sanhedrin came along later and conveyed that information. But then again, later he talks about what Festus and Agrippa said to each other in their private apartments in Acts chapters 25 and 26. And it's very unlikely they had another source for that, so that almost certainly had to be direct revelation of the Holy Spirit. And so there are very likely some facts recorded in Acts that were not there